Okay, so I'm going to present this work called Energy Proportionality for Storage, Impact and Feasibility. So we've been seeing the last couple of years that it basically that processor has become increasingly more efficient. For instance, in 2005, we saw one core would use about 100 watts of power, while this would use only 15 watts. But we see that for 5 years later, we see that this remains the same, but the CPU cores are a lot less power hungry. And this this is because processor has introduced technologies like DVFS that regulate the amount of energy that the processor is using by scaling down an octave frequency. And also that we see that and this has led to storage being now one of the most power hungry components of the data center. So in this graph, we see that the IT equipment, which is storage, disk, CPU, servers, both service and storage and networking, is about 50% of the power. And if we further split up, we see that servers are half of that power usage, while storage is about 40%. And this is a huge number. And not only that, but this number is increasing every time because multiple factors that I will detail later. For instance, disks are not becoming more. We need more disks to have this to keep up with the demands and the rate that disks are the power of this is being sort of low, right? So. It's also predicted that within 5 years, storage unit sales will be bigger than server sales. Also that, like I said before, increases in drive capacity are slowing. Previous years, we saw that every 18 months, we used to have double the capacity at about the same price. We've seen that the disk the capacity has sort of stayed at 1 terabyte, it's not going to increase much more than that. That leads to having to use a lot more disk to keep up with user data requirements. And the other fact is very important is that data centers are migrating to 2.5-inch drives, which are the typical laptop hard drives, which use a lot less power. But also have less capacity, so you require a lot more of them, right? Okay, so our argument is that right now we need to have, storage needs to be energy proportional. But that's not enough, right? So why isn't that enough? So the thing is that a storage system utilization is highly variable. And not only that, but storage is a stateful resource, right? You write something and you hope to get something back. What you wrote, you hope to get it back. Whereas CPU is just running instructions and just doing some calculations, right? It doesn't have a state. So in order to implement a change in storage, it's very, very it's something that takes time because you have to apply different techniques that require data movement and possibly other things that will use resources. And our argument is that we're going to focus energy proportionality on two aspects, right? So the first one is when performance matters the most, and the other one is when energy matters the most, right? It's going to be a sort of knob that the system administrator will be able to tune depending on its need. And right there at the bottom, we see that how current storage systems are and what is our ideal objective, right? So we want to be proportional, that means that if we have zero I/O load, we use zero power, and if we have a peak I/O load, we use peak power. And everything in between, try to make it proportional.
Whether energy matters the most or performance matters the most is a question of priority that's set by the system administrator.
Yes, exactly. That's a question of priority that will be set by the system administrator depending on his particular scenario.
And you want to build systems or energy proportional systems that can be tuned to either priority or?
Yes. So the idea is that for independent priorities, you have different uses of the different types of disk, right? So let's say we're using three types of disk, SSDs, SAS, and SATA drives, right? They all have different performance characteristics, different number of IOPS that they support and all that. And if you would want most performance, you would want to do something like put the hottest thing on the SSD. But if you want more energy savings, you would want to probably spread out and use the minimum number of drives that possible, right?
So the idea is to build a system that can adapt to either priority.
Our focus is going to be mostly on what energy matters the most, but we're going to cover techniques that can be used for the other case when performance matters the most. But the system is not going to be self-adaptive or anything like that. Okay. So just to illustrate our point. We studied data from a financial data center.
So, I didn't understand how the performance will matter if you apply this energy or proportionality of energy.
How performance will matter?
Yeah.
Okay, because let's assume that we have different goals. One goal is maximize performance and the other one is minimize energy. If we want to maximize performance, we may want to use more disk to decrease the response time of the IOPS, right? But if we want to minimize power consumption, we would want to use less drives and pack them to a level where they're almost 100% utilized, so that you're using drives almost fully. But that's when where they're most efficient in terms of energy.
About capacity and not really throughput.
In the case of energy, it's about both throughput and capacity, because we're gonna try to deliver the same amount of throughput, but with using less number of drives, like a more efficient packing, right? Because let's say, for instance, you have some drive where you have some very fixed parts of the drive that are very highly utilized, and the 90% rest of the hard drive is not used at all, right? And you have other drives that have similar characteristics. So what we're going to do is we're going to get those hot portions, put them in an SSD probably or a SAS, and those other two drives the remaining 90% of the drives of both drives, we're going to put them to sleep and just use the SAS drive, for instance.
So you are proposing specific techniques for such as what you just described in this paper, or is it more of
Yes.
an evaluation of various possibilities?
So we're going to describe various techniques that can be used, and I'm later going to explain a framework that we propose and that we're currently building. All right, so this is both. We're not saying that our framework is the only solution or is the best solution. We're just saying that it's a solution that could achieve energy proportionality. Okay. So this is just to illustrate our case. And this is data we collected from a financial data center. it has 10 large storage systems. There are more than 10,000 volumes, and we have a trace of 160 days. So we have, and from each 160 days, we have 5 minutes I/O summary intervals that say how many I/Os in that interval, how many of them were read, how many of them were write, and all that information. So we analyze that data, and here we see the PDF, and we see that approximately 20% of the time, volumes are idle. That is, they have 0% utilization. And then we see that they're decreasingly, the utilization decreases a lot until you get to 100. Right, and then we see very, very few volumes that are always being used.
What is the unit for utilization?
Percentage.
I mean, what unit is IELTS?
Percentage IELTS.
Over the maximum.
Over the maximum. Yeah. So, if we look at this overall, we see that the average utilization in terms of IELTS is less than 60%, and that if we had an ideally proportional energy proportional system, our energy savings would be more than 40%, according to our estimates.
I'm confused about this graph. So, okay. You take measurements every 5 minutes, or
no. I mean the samples that I have are collected are from 5 minutes summarization. I mean, I don't have IO by IO.
Okay.
For every 5 minute interval, I have how many IOs were in that interval. And let's say how many of them were reads, how many of them are for writes, how many were sequential, how many were random, and some data in 5 minute intervals.
Every 5 minutes you have some. And then how do you calculate the percentage utilization from that?
Okay, Mark. Yeah. So the maximum we know each volume where it's placed. Right? It's in, let's say, a RAID of 7 disks with such type of drive. So we do a simple calculation and says, okay, if we have, we assume that each drive has X capacity in terms of IOPS, and then we and when we look at how much IOPS capacity that drive is delivering, and then we simply say, okay, this is delivering. It's maximum IOPS capacity of the array is 100 IOPS, and it's delivering 20. So it's 20% utilized.
Okay.
And then we look at all the volumes that are in the array.
So you calculate the average utilization across all the 5 minute intervals for each volume?
Yes, for each volume we looked at all the 160 days. And this is the average.
For each volume.
For each volume.
So 40% utilization does not mean that a certain volume, or its percentage of time. Okay. So percentage of time takes into account that for certain intervals, that one line is not per volume, right?
One line is per percentage utilization.
Okay.
Why is percentage of time? So let's say this line here, or let's say this one here, or one that's about, okay, this one here,
mm-hmm.
says that about 80 or 90% of the time, at 0.5% of the time, volumes are about 91% in the line.
So let's take 1 5-minute interval.
Mm-hmm.
The probability of volumes being 90% utilized is 0.5 or 0.005.
Yes.
That's what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So you take any 5-minute interval, what is the probability that you will find a single volume to be 90% utilized?
Well, there are some volumes that you will have 100%, right? Because they're always used.
Also, and
there are some volumes that will have less. This is what.
Is the statement correct that in a 5-minute interval, the probability that a volume is 90% utilized is 0.005. Is that one way to interpret this graph?
In a particular there any volume. You're saying
yeah,
any
that
volume.
Any volume.
Yeah, 0.0. Yes. Correct. Okay. So and now if we look at it, okay, this doesn't look good here. Okay. If we put time on the x-axis and we see that and we have a heat map that is big, very tiny, and darker colors means more ionosity. We see that some extents don't get absolutely any ion, right? This one here, they're completely white. Most of the extents experience a variable degree of activity, right? So we have different shades of gray. And very few of them are highly active, are always active, right? So this is for another workload. This is a transactional database workload, and this is how it behaves for a one-day interval.
Okay. You're talking about extents as opposed to volumes, which I'm assuming is a different thing.
Yeah, so sorry, I forgot to introduce that metric. So, the previous one was in volume. So so now we split the volumes into 1 gigabyte units that we call extents. Right, and each line represents an extent. And each line on the x-axis represents a time interval that is, I think it's 1 second.
So the y-axis is all the extents in all the volumes, or?
Okay, yeah, this is a different workload. This is a smaller workload and for just one
single
system.
Single volume.
Yeah. This is just one volume.
Okay.
So.
Oh, but.
Yeah.
Up there it says 14 1 terabyte volumes. So there are 14 volumes.
No.
What
no,
is
no.
the volume size? Yeah?
No, there are. That's not 14 more. No, I think it's 14.1 terabyte.
Oh, 14.1 terabyte.
Yeah.
yeah,
I'm sorry. Something I have to correct. Okay. So. This is basically to see that you have a high level of variability with of volume usage, of extent usage, right? It's not like it's always the same or anything like that. Some extents are used, some are not, and you have to treat them differently, right? Okay.
And that's over 140 days again?
No, this is over 1 day.
1 day.
Okay, so the thing is that, energy proportionality is now, it's a little hard to achieve because, like I said, storage is a stateful resource, right? In order you want to read the same thing that you wrote before. So every time you, in order to migrate something, if you have to think that, and it's located in the same device, and you want to achieve better performance, you cannot. You see, that device has some capacity. You have to either move it to a faster device or put a RAID or something like that. You have to do something in order to obtain a better performance. That puts us in a very tough situation because most of the techniques that have been designed are migration-based because they require you to take that data and put it in another place in order to scale on performance.
But
right?
In that case, you lose energy efficiency, right?
You could lose energy efficiency. It depends, right?
But why is it not the case in case of processors or memory?
Because processor is just executing instructions. A processor for one instruction is always going to have the same output. It's independent of, you can take the same data and run it on another processor, you will get the same result. You cannot take the same set of reads and write commands and execute it on a different drive and get the same result. Right? A disk drive is a stateful device.
What about replication-based approach? Are you going to talk about that? Or?
Yes, a little bit, but not that much. We didn't consider replication-based approach because, we didn't consider them that much. Yeah. Okay, so these are some of the techniques that we consider. So if we start, we have here the technique, the time it takes to implement that technique, and the potential to alter performance. So consolidation is basically grouping things together in order to achieve higher energy efficiency. And that takes a lot of time because you have to move things and also can lessen response times while you're, because now everything that used to be spread, now it's in one place, and if they all get access at the same time, you could probably have some...
So where's the clock in?
It's the time it takes to implement that technique.
You mean
to consolidate?
Or
No. If you're going to do a consolidation, it's going to take a lot of time.
Okay.
Right? So if you're going to do tiering, it's going to take a little less time if you implement it wisely.
Okay.
Right? IO loading takes very little time. That could be either write or peak uploading. Adaptive peak also takes small time. It's just basically implemented in the disk framework. Workload shaping.
The clock means that they don't adapt well to
that every time you the clock means that every time you have to do one of these things, it's going
to
take this amount
of
time.
But you have to do one of these things because load changes, right?
Exactly.
So that means that they don't adapt well to changes in load.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, the bigger the bigger the clock, the less adaptive it is to a non-stable workload. Okay, so. So the other techniques are opportunistic spin down, which can delay the system depending on how much time it takes to spin up the drive again, main and then dedupe or compression, but it's an online technique. Okay, so we were focused with that challenge. And so the first thing that we did is that we're going to take this whole bunch of application techniques that we have, of techniques that we're going to have, and we're going to put them in an analyzer that's going to take some application requirements and some workload characteristics, right? And the application requirements look like this. So some applications are highly sensible to average response time. And also highly sensible to peak response time. For instance, if you're streaming content, you don't want to pause in that stream, right? You want it to be always streaming.
It's sensitive, not sensible, right? Sensible.
Sensitive.
Yeah.
Sensitive.
Yeah.
I said sensible. Yeah. Sorry. there are other workloads that are that have low sensitivity to average response time and high sensitivity to peak response time. I forgot the example about this one. But
will it be a what server for me?
What?
Will it be a what server in a better way?
It's a video, maybe a video application.
Video application could be. Yeah, the thing is that you're not supposed to break in the middle, mm-hmm. right? Okay. And the last one that we have is low sensitivity to average response time and low sensitivity to peak response time. Okay, so
those are maybe batch applications.
Yeah, those are basically applications that you submit and then get the results back.
Okay, so that's from the application point of view. From the workloads point of view, what we've seen indicates that workloads are that 90% of the time workloads are steady. That means that they tend to be either active or inactive, but to remain in the same state for the same group of data portion, right? And within that, we see that that most of the time you're spent more than 20% and less than 80%. Sorry, those signs are inverted. And okay, so I'm a little constrained. So the point being here is that if we look at this within this table, where we put in one column the sensitivity to response time, the sensitivity to peak response time, and the stability of the workload, what we're going to be focusing on is this part here. So we're going to be focusing on applications that are sensible to response time, that are not so sensible to peak response time, and that are fairly stable, because we saw that that's where most of the activity is, right? So and we see that for that particular set, the techniques that we can apply are consolidation, tiering, spin down, workload shaping, and basically those. Okay, so how do we quantify the differences in gains of the different techniques? So we built this system that has four components. The first one is an I/O dispatcher that gets I/O issued by applications. It logs that information within an I/O monitor that then analyzes I/O. Passes those I/O tasks to the analyzer, which will create an optimization plan, and then the plan coordinator will finally execute the plan and change the state on the underlying storage system. Right. Okay. So our technique is going to be mainly focused on putting I mentioned before that we split the volume into 1 gigabyte extents. And for those 1 gigabyte extents, we're going to classify them, and we're going to put them on the device where they should be, depending on their I/O characteristics. Right? So let's say we have an extent that is very, very active, that's always being used. So that guy should belong in an SSD, because that's where its performance is going to be the best. Right, if we have a guy that's in the middle, I mean, it's sometimes very used, sometimes not that used, we're going to put them on a SAS tier. And if we have things that are not very used, I mean, very seldomly used, once a day or less, we're going to put them on a SATA tier, right? And the idea is that we're then going to pack devices and try to keep active the least number of devices, of arrays. So we're going to have arrays that are almost 100% utilized all the time, because we're going to minimize the number of arrays that we're going to use. Right? So for instance, in this example, we have three different device types, SATA, SAS, and SSD. Each has different IOPS characteristics. The SAS has 100 IOPS and 100 gigabytes. The SATA can give you about 50 IOPS and 1 terabyte capacity. And the SSD will give you approximately 50,000 I/O, and it has about 100 gigabyte capacity. So we see that if we use a normal SAS configuration, that is what's typical right now in data centers where you need performance, we're going to be using about 100 watts for performance, 100 watts of power. However, if we use just one one SSD packed with the most, with the, let's say, the hottest content, and one SATA device packed with the bottom not so used content, we're going to use only 8 watts of power, and that's considering that we're going to, that both devices are going to be active all the time, right? So it's less than 1/3 of the power usage that the all SAS configuration has.
This ignores cost, though. The cost of the SSD, are you equating the cost on both sides of the...
Yeah, so I don't have those numbers here, but we did make those calculations, and it turns out that approximately in 1 year, the cost of the SSD would be, you would reach the break-even point if you're using the SSD a lot, right? If you're storing the highly used data on the SSD, let's say the top 5% of the data on the SSD, whereas the SAS configuration, all SAS configuration.
The other comment I had was the SSD is good for reads, but it's not very good for writes.
Okay, yeah. So we're assuming here that we're going to be using enterprise-grade SSDs, where the difference of the reads and writes is not that big. I mean, it's probably, you could all probably get 50K IOPS for reads, and let's say 25K IOPS for writes, for random writes. Right, so it's, I mean, there's still a twofold, double the IOPS capacity, but it's not like for low level SSD.
Sorry, I have another comment. So if you are going to deploy something like this, it seems like for this example, you have 3 different devices, right? So it seems like you need to know beforehand the workload that you should have. Because you need to know exactly how many SSD you're going to buy, how many DLC you're going to buy, and stuff. Okay? So I don't know if that is a problem or...
Actually, no. Because, like I said, so we're constantly monitoring IO activity. And even if we have... I mean, we're just going to use the resources that we have in the best way. Even if we don't have SSD, we have only 2 types of devices, let's say SAS and SATA.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to try to pack everything into the most energy-efficient configuration, right? I mean, we're not required to have, let's say, SSD all the time. Our system will adapt depending on the type of drive it can play with,
mm-hmm.
Right? So in that sense, if you later decide to buy a whole bunch of SSDs, then the system will readapt and reconfigure itself to handle those SSDs. If you decide to buy more SATA, it will also adapt to that, right? You had a question?
I had a general comment. So
mm-hmm.
Here you're assuming that you have all these devices at your disposal, and then you choose which configuration is the best at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, is that...
Yes.
Okay. And which of the techniques that you described is the one that you're instantiating?
So like I said, our technique is mostly based on tiering and migration. So we're going to... tiering in the sense that we're going to put data on different devices depending on their IOPS characteristics. And migration is because we're going to migrate data from different devices in an online fashion.
Mm-hmm. So this is not consolidation in your definition?
This is not consolidation in the sense that probably I'm going to be using the same number of storage nodes at the end, just that... because in one phase, the last... So what we do is that the first step is that we classify extents into different devices, and then we actually make a migration plan. And the last thing that we do is that we try to minimize the number of devices that we're using. So in that last space, we're consolidating into as few number of arrays as possible to minimize power consumption.
So, but there is no replication.
There's no replication. Data is only occurs once because we're assuming that the underlying medium is sufficiently reliable. Because here we're not going to be migrating between different devices. We're going to be migrating between different arrays. Right? Let's say this is just an illustrative example, but all these are arrays. Typically, because that's the typical data center configuration we have. Where you cannot reference to a particular device, but to an array, to different arrays. Yes.
Another question. Talking about reliability, this is basically, I guess, a question for the IO monitor. When, let's say, the user decides to move with the frequently active data,
mm-hmm.
You have maximum performance.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you choose to set devices in this case. You said that the assumption is that these devices are reliable, but
yeah.
Sometimes there are failures in this, and let's say they are arranged in a
yeah.
general way.
So,
and but just let me finish
okay.
first. And then they may become like unstable somewhat, or they may start some rebuild process because
mm-hmm.
there's a faulty disk and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one case. And another case is that. Somewhat the predictability of the performance of the SSD is also variable. When it's under high log, it will start doing internal operations like
mm-hmm.
garbage collection that will not respond as quickly as possible or as quickly as it was responding before this high log was reached.
Okay, so the first thing is that, okay, I forgot the question. Sorry.
Reliability.
The reliability.
Under
okay, so
conditions.
So these are problems that have been studied before, and we're not going to focus on that. We're going to just say that we have a reliable enough method to transfer to migrate one guy from this device to another device, and that's going to be reliable, right? Because that's a different problem that we don't study. We're just focusing on how much energy we can save. Right, and the other thing about the SSD is that again, enterprise level SSDs have different characteristics from low level consumer level SSDs. So for enterprise level SSDs, you do have some place where the SSD starts performing garbage collection, but the impact is not as high as in the other case. In the consumer level SSD, you see that. Those drives get affected a lot, but in these devices, of course, you pay that when you buy the device. Let's say a consumer level SSD costs about $500, and this device costs 10 times that, about $5,000. But the performance guarantees you get with this type of devices is a lot higher, in that sense. I didn't study that personally, but other people did, and. They came to that conclusion.
It might be good to have some of those references in
okay.
handy, so you can actually
okay.
talk about it.
Okay, so this is basically the algorithm. I don't know if I still have time. I think I'm a little over. But this is basically the algorithm I explained. First, I pick the tier that best fits it. And the second step, I pack everything into the minimum number of devices, and then I migrate. In the migration, what I try to do is try to minimize the number of migrations of data movements that you do. So let's say you had an extent that was previously on SAS, and now it's also on SAS, but in a different array. So you try not to migrate it within arrays, right? And that sort of stuff. You try to minimize the number of migrations. Our current algorithm is very basic. We have many things that we can improve, and we're currently working on it. And that's it. So if you had any additional questions or comments? This was in Almaden.
So I had a general comment. I think it's about the tone of the presentation. I think because this is not a complete study,
mm-hmm.
it is hard to make any strong claims to say that, okay, this will work this way, or, you know, it will have low overhead, or it will be. So I think it's more, I see this work more at this point, at this
mm-hmm.
stage of maturity, more as a potential, you know, investigation
mm-hmm.
of potential. And you can say, okay, this is what we can potentially get. And if there are questions that say that, okay, but what about this overhead and that overhead, instead of saying, okay, it would be small, or we, you know, we expect it to be small, we can say that, okay, yes, that needs to be further investigated, and, you know, that
okay.
is what we are doing right now. Our goal in the study is to explore all the different techniques in which energy proportional storage can be implemented.
Okay.
So on that same account, the last example for tiering and migration can actually be avoided completely. That's in my opinion, because
okay.
the very specific solution that you're proposing, but you haven't investigated it completely, you don't have results, so, you know, that would be one candidate
okay.
to eliminate from the presentation.
Okay, yeah, and very specific, I mean, I think I went too fast in that part, which was one thing that we needed. Okay.
Yeah, and it could be that maybe you're already working on some of these and you have the answers,
mm-hmm.
but given that you're presenting a different
yeah.
type of work, it might be more appropriate to, you know, tone down the claims a little bit and just hand wave, say, okay, we are still looking into it, and, you know, we just wanted to open up this new area of research.
Okay.
We wanted to, in some sense, investigate the taxonomy of different techniques that are possible and can be used for building any deep proportional storage.
Okay. No more questions.
Yeah, no,
well,
sorry, go ahead. Mine is not technical at all.
Say that you pick some type of application because I didn't understand your argument for choosing those type of applications. The type, you know, load something, like something, sensitive, based on the sensitivity
okay.
to the average response time. And why did you choose that type of application?
Why that categorization?
Yeah.
I mean,
no. Exactly. Why
yeah,
are you working with that?
Oh, because that's the most common. From
why?
I mean.
Based on what?
Based on the data that we have, we saw that was the most common case.
You mean IBM worked mostly with applications?
Yeah, with customers that have that.
Which are what type
customers.
Of application?
Which are what applications?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just, I don't know what application. The systems that we studied were running some customer data, and that data reflected that the characteristics, the IO characteristics were of that type.
Yeah, but I mean, you're referring to applications that are sensitive to that thing that you're observing. So you're observing something, and you're claiming that application care or not care about this thing that you're observing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you need this, how it affects this also, right?
Okay,
and
so
you're
seeing, yeah,
you're
okay.
seeing this, and
yeah.
you're basing the categorization of this that also sees this.
Yeah, so you're, okay, so let me go back to that point. So basically you're talking about,
yeah,
here, right? Here.
Yeah. That.
No, this one.
Yeah.
That this is okay. So this is a categorization of both applications and how workload varies.
Yeah. What I'm saying first, I mean, the second thing I'm saying is, how do you categorize an application to be in one of those squares based on only traces?
So okay. So we're not categorizing applications. And what I'm saying is that this is what's most common.
No, I'm saying to be able to say that the most
to
common
be
type
able
of applications you saw, you had to categorize your applications somehow, right?
How? I guess the question is, how do you know the workloads you
are like that? Yeah.
Do you analyze are in that shadow?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. So. Yeah,
I think this ties back to my earlier comment, which is the tone of the presentation. I think if you don't make strong claims, I think
mm-hmm.
you'll be much better off. For instance, you can say that some of the workloads that we studied at IBM had very high sensitivity to average response time, but had little sensitivity to peak response time. And for those workloads, the set of techniques that would be applicable are shown in this figure. Instead of saying, okay, these are the techniques that are the best techniques, because they apply to all workloads, right? So you could tone down that statement. Because that's really what you're doing. In fact, you're creating a taxonomy that takes all possibilities into account, and you just describe one of those possibilities.
Yeah.
That's
true.
No,
we're basically just measuring the time from which I issue it to the server and get it back. So
outside
of the server. Yes. So the idea is that this is a virtualized component which all the IO is issued to, and he sends it to actual physical device. So he gets a virtual IO, let's say, read this file, this thing, not this file, but read this address, and he will transfer. Transform that into an actual IO to a physical device. And that, and then we measure that the time where from which I issue it here to which it responds in the physical device. So that includes network time and probably IOs time in the IO stack in the node and all that.
So
that
you only have an overall file. You don't have a detailed
timing also. Yeah, because I measure that per IO.
For IO.
Yeah, we measure it per IO.
Yeah, I mean, for each IO request, each request, you mean that you measure the time spent.
The
stack, it's the physical network, break this time down to the individual CPU.
No, we don't break that down. We're
just everything together.
Yes, we
end to end.
End to end.
Response time.
Yeah. So let's say if you have a locally attached data and a remote attached data, obviously for the local one it's gonna be more precise than for the other one. Because it's gonna include less overhead from network and the other stuff. But the thing is that in typical data center environments you have devices that are connected via fiber channel and that sort of thing, where the response to, where it's basically a box to which you issue commands to, and that has very little overhead, right?
Okay, I think we can move on to the next discussion.
Okay, thank you. So that's all I have. Okay.
Who wants to model IO model or
device model?
Consolidation.
Yeah. I guess it involves separate.
Okay. Yeah, it's plugging in here.
Underneath that.
Yeah.
You can move here if you want.
Or closer to people, it's really hot.
The colors are really bad. You said no more. Lower the resolution.
Lower the resolution?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
the buttons are supposed to be orange.
I don't know.
The what?
The
okay.
Yeah, the color.
There are five different appearance, right?
Five.
Actually, five.
Right.
Two of them are two.
I mean,
set. And one, which is very good. And actually, that one says.
The colors are always going to be bad.
Big issue with this is trying to hide it. I guess trying to hide things.
Put the lower one. 1024 by.
This
760.
It's
fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm gonna do the. I'm gonna present the research what I was focusing on for last few months, for probably a year. So
can you remove that small window from there?
Yeah, sure.
Is that possible? Or?
Yeah. So that's the work I'm doing for some time. So this is application performance modeling in a virtualized environment. So before going to the talk, I'm going to present why is application performance modeling is important in virtualized environment. So application performance modeling is already important in the data center business operation, because in data center business operation, what typically they want to employ, because they have a fixed number of resources and they want to measure how the application performance changes as they change the resources allotted to them. So this has been in the scenario before the virtualization, before even in the non-virtualized cases, if they want to, before employing an application, they measure how much hardware that application actually needs. So that's why they measure the cost of the hardware. And that's how the application is actually deployed in the data center. So now, when the virtualization comes into the picture, it becomes more important, because what virtualization allows you to do is that it allows more co-consolidation and more sharing of resources. So which that means is that instead of now application being run in a single operating or single machine, single hardware resources, you are actually allowing several applications to run on the shared resources. Because what virtualization allows you to do is that one application can run in its own operating system environment, and it has its own virtual view of the resources. So that means a single hardware or single resource can employ can host many operating systems, which in turn hosts many applications. So now, thing is that as the resources are shared, it is very important to know that how the application behavior will change as you change the resources to one application versus another application that is actually sharing the same resources. So because
as you also said, that the performance of an application or a business application that changes based on the resources it's been allocated. And in virtualization, as the resources are shared, so one allotment of resource to a particular application may actually affect another application that is actually sharing the same resources. So it's very critical to have a good performance modeling of an application. So what this efficient resource provisioning will guarantee is that it will guarantee increased resource sharing, and of course that increased resource sharing means reduced cost. And most importantly, it will allow you to employ SLA-based maximization metrics. So I want to talk about that in later. So what is the main challenges involved in this performance modeling is that the identification of correct minimal generic set of influencing parameters, because in virtualization you have, because an application performance may be changed by any kind of parameter. Let's say it could be a CPU share, it could be a memory, or it could be IO bandwidth. So you need to understand, so what are the parameters that actually change application performance metrics. And those parameter selection is very important because it has to be correct, so it will accurately represent the type of resources it's actually sharing, and it has to be minimum, or let's say it has to be less in number. I won't say minimal, but it has to be less in number, because as you increase the number of parameters, your model complexity grows. So you have to find out the parameters which is representative of all types of resources and which is less in numbers, because that's how your modeling complexity will be reduced. And it should be generic, because it generic means those techniques or those type of parameters should be applicable to any operating system or any virtualization solution as well. So the selection of parameters is really important in this case.
So one question, so what happens if an application modifies the resource that it uses the most over time? Let's say you have an application that initially reads a huge data set from this and then does a whole bunch of calculation and then writes it again. Right, so it's using basically two resources but at different times. First it's using this, and then it's using memory and CPU, potentially.
Yeah,
and then it's using this again.
But you have an application throughput, right? So we are going to measure that usage. So the thing is that we are measuring by end-to-end. So if your application measures returns the power or throughput or the application performance metric in a single amount, so it doesn't matter whether it's using that amount of resources within that time.
I guess George is asking, what if the behavior of the application changes over time?
Mm-hmm.
So the model that you create at time instant 0 may not be at time 10, because the application is now behaving completely differently.
Yeah, then to answer your question is that the model will be updated in nature. So we'll change the model as the behavior of the application changes.
Okay.
So for example, right now the version I implemented is the static version.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it has been implemented, it can be updated automatically depending on the, or so let's say I want to update the model in 10 second interval.
Okay.
Or a 5-minute interval, then automatically it will understand, okay, this for now, right now the CPU is not being used for application A, so in that case we can reduce the CPU share at that time.
Okay.
Or the application performance metric at that during that instant is not dependent on the CPU.
Okay.
It's dependent on something else that is memory. And so the correct set of parameters, and what is more important is that with the correct set of parameters we have to come up with an performance model that is accurate in predicting application performance. Now, predicting application performance is important because in data center environment, what an administrator wants, that administrator wants an automatic tool that will tell him that, okay, now I want to, because let's say there are four applications, A, B, C, D. Now, application A is not using the CPU anymore. So what will happen if I change the CPU or reduce the CPU share, what will be the performance metric? So those kind of knowledge is critical to critical for database administrator or data center administrator to know.
But this is single system, right? You're studying this under single system.
What do you mean by single
system? I mean, you're not studying, let's say you have a whole bunch of machines, of resources, and then you're allocating VMs to physical machines. You're just, you have one machine and varying the resource that you allocate to different VMs, right?
Yeah, it's one physical machine.
Okay.
And there are different virtual machines that is residing on the same physical machine.
But your idea is to expand it to?
Expand it to some to a cluster environment. So this is a typical scenario what I was talking about. So you have the virtual machine monitor. So that is actually controlling the resources. And you have several instances of virtual machines. Each virtual machine is hosting an application. And what we are measuring is that, so these are the parameters, the parameters we are tuning to the virtual machine. So the application, and it reports the application performance metric. And so what parts of the performance model, what it monitors is that it first monitors the resource parameters or the parameter or input parameters that has been applied to the virtual machine, and it also monitors the application performance metric it reported. So what the performance model will do is that based on this observation, it will come up with a model that will tell in the application performance metric given a set of resource inputs.
Does everybody understand?
And so different applications sharing the same VM?
Yeah, you just mentioned
that the heavy VM. Yeah, that's because, I mean, if you allow two applications to reside on the same virtual machine, you cannot really guarantee resource isolation to those specific applications. I mean, that's why virtualization comes into picture. So what used to happen before is that you have a single machine, and there are two applications running, let's say. So you cannot really guarantee, okay, I will give this amount of resource to application A and this amount of resource to application B. So this was
not going
For example, two applications share a CPU, although it's a lot of CPU and more. But two applications will share a lot of CPU and share a lot of memory. If you do it, you can have some kind of guarantee to control share.
But what about the memory?
Yeah, memory is a traditional,
I mean, if you schedule CPU, let's say, with the nice thing, you can schedule the priority, but you can place a hard limit on an application, right? You can prioritize between two applications, but you can prioritize, okay, this application cannot use more than 20% of the CPU, let's say, and this application cannot use more than 40% of the CPU.
It depends on
But this is hard.
Yeah.
I mean, in virtualization, you could easily control those type of resources.
So, I mean, virtualization is just a particular implementation. If you borrow that idea from them, to the industry,
I guess your point is that this same picture could be applied to a single OS and multiple applications if those parameters could be matched into corresponding parameters within a single operating system.
Right. But I just feel that this question has changed.
I think Sajeev should answer this question, but the idea is that we want to apply this technique in virtualized data centers, mm-hmm. where the current trend is that for each application you use an independent virtual machine. Let's say you're running multiple web servers, you have one VM allocated to each web service. and it provides a mechanism to sandbox the application with strict guarantees. Right? And that's the trend right now, which is that virtualization provides the strict partitioning of resources on a single machine. And that's one of the reasons why virtualization is so popular today, because it gives that ability. And the other thing is that if you run two applications within a single OS, there are security concerns. Right? One application may not trust the other application, and may not trust the operating system either. So service providers want complete control on all the software that they run. Now, of course, the virtual machine monitor is run by the data center administrator, but if there is a strict partition between what the VM sees and what the application does, and it seems like that model is acceptable to most application service providers, and they're okay with running their applications on third-party virtual machine monitors.
So the assumption is that this application is custom.
I guess it's okay as long as you create a single application performance metric, which could take into account, like, let's say, the average of the two applications. Since the model that we are creating is under the assumption that there is a single application performance metric.
I mean, you could think about it, okay, an application can have several tiers. Let's say one client, he has two applications. One is the web server application, one is the database application. So in that case, they could host the database server and the web server in the same virtual machine if they want. If their required goal is to only measure the end-to-end response time.
In some sense, we're not making any assumption as to the number of applications within a VM. All we care about is there a single application performance metric or not in the end.
But we took this approach, we say that even in the paper, because one application is included instead of one virtual machine, because that's the trend, usual trend. So any question on that? I can move on. So, okay, so in the beginning of the slide, I explained that parameter selection is important, right? I say that because this virtual machine monitor is actually taking into account all types of resources like CPU, memory, I/O, and network as well. So our parameter selection is important because it should represent all types of resources. And so now I differentiate between the parameters as well. One is the controlled parameter and one is the observable parameter. The controlled parameter is that which actually lets you control the or help you put a hard limit on that type of resources. So let's say CPU. So all the typical virtualization solutions, what they allow you, you can put a hard limit on the percentage share of CPU that the virtual machine can use. So, and the VMM can control those parameters. So CPU and memory actually falls into the category where you can easily control those parameters from the VMM. And here's the most important thing is that all those people ask, why do you choose allocation over CPU usage, right? I mean, we are placing a hard limit on the CPU of a VM, but it may happen that the virtual machine, I allocated 20% CPU. It's not actually using 20% of the CPU. It's probably using in its peak time 10% of the overall CPU utilization. So you may ask, okay, then in that case, you are not using all the available CPU. You're actually wasting it. But we chose it because of the reason is that CPU usage is not a controllable parameter. It's an observable parameter, right? And CPU usage changes dynamically because it may happen in the peak time the CPU usage is 10%, but all the other time it is less than that. So you cannot really enforce the control over CPU usage. right? And but you will say that we will lose the value of the CPU share for that application. But as I told you in the beginning, that our model is adaptable, so it could change based on the application performance and its need of resource usage. So in later case, if they find that okay, CPU is not used to its full extent, they could reduce the number of CPU. The model will automatically guarantee that, the online version of the model. And there are some observable parameters. There is a D-scan network. Now, why did they choose D-scan network as an observable variable, is CPU as a controllable? Why D-scan network is not a controllable parameter? Why can't, because that goes back to the unavailability of the current solution that will guarantee that, okay, that VM can use this amount of I/O bandwidth or this amount of network versus bandwidth. So those kind of techniques are not really available, the accurate techniques. So in that case, we have to fall back to the observable parameters for this kind of network. And how I measure, how I account for this kind of network? So in operating system, you can schedule the disk I/O, or you can change the propriety of an I/O.
That's a control panel. I mean, I/O nights are control panels.
Yeah, I'm coming to the story. So yeah, that's the control panel.
So it should go up there.
Yeah, I/O nights should go up there. So how I, let's say, how I control the disk and network usage. So there's two parameters. One is the priority, and one is the competition. So what is the priority? Priority is that, it's let's say, talk about this. So it's ionized, that is in case of Linux, of course. So with the help of ionized, you could prioritize one I/O over another I/O issued by different processes. So in that case, let's say if your priority is more, so application A is prioritized over application B, in that case, application will have more amount of time to send the I/O request. But selecting only priority is not enough because it's competitive in nature. Let's say you have two applications with the same priority, 3 and 3. But that doesn't mean that both of the applications will perform the same way, because in case of I/O, the competition is very important because the disk is shared. So if one application is requesting more number of I/O requests and another application is also some number of I/O requests, but if your competing I/O request is changed or is more, it may happen that even with the same priority, you could encounter lesser performance. Because because the disk is shared. So somehow you need to take into account competition as well. Now this competition is not an observed parameter, although ionized is a control parameter, but observed competition is not an observable parameter. It is not a controllable parameter, it's an observed parameter. So with the combination of those two, this represents the disk parameter. So the network usage is the same as the disk.
So how do you represent the competition?
Yeah, competition, let's say this is application A, this is application B, this is application C, right? So we know the CPU and memory and the I/O nights. But how do we monitor the competition, right? That's your question. So with the VMM, you could monitor the I/O request by all those VMs. So competition means I/O request of B plus I/O request of C. So that would be the competition parameter.
I/O operations per second.
Oh.
I/O.
IOP.
IOP.
So So it's not the I/O issued by the application VM itself. It's the I/O issued by all the other VMs. That's the competition. So in network it's the same. So instead of I/O, you have NICE because it's a CPU scheduling process. So this is a Zen specific architecture.
I think you can skip this because I think let's stick to the more abstract.
Okay. So this is what we. What I discussed about the parameter selection. So in Zen, I have separate. Even if I talk about more abstract cases, but in Zen, you have several mechanisms to allow you to guarantee those, employ those control parameters as well as those observable parameters. So I'm not going into details into that. So let's talk about different models. So now the parameter is selected. So now our main the next challenge is to devise a model which will accurately predict application performance with in regards to those parameters. So what we did is that basically what we did is that we first trained the model.
So how do you distinguish between the thing is that if you have an application that is swapping a lot because it's currently using because it doesn't have enough memory, let's say. So how do you detect that?
That's a good question.
What is the question again?
So if an application is using the swap very intensively because it doesn't have enough memory, how do you detect that?
There will be a change in the performance at the same.
Yeah, it will start requesting more disk, right?
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to distinguish the as request when you read this?
But at the end it will start just issuing, giving it more priority in the disk and not more memory.
Yeah,
that is what it, the application wants.
I'm telling you, because at some point what will happen, because IO priority is, you cannot go beyond a certain range. So even if you give them a highest priority, you notice, the model will notice the application performance is not changing.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it will just shift to memory.
Okay, so probably that will do it.
Say that again?
See, the way the updation of modeling will happen is that you start changing the allocation for each step to the VM. So let's say in this case what George said is that, okay, he's issuing a lot of paging because the memory is very poor, the allocated memory. So what usually the model will tell you is to change the IO to priority because it is issuing a lot of IO requests, right? But you observed, the model will observe that even changing the IO9, the application performance metric is not changing. So in that case, what in the next round, what the model will guarantee is it will, instead of changing IO9, it will change the memory. In that case, you will observe a change in application performance.
And it will happen that before memory, you change CPU first?
It could happen, depends on the, at that time, what, I mean,
so I think we are mixing two things here. The first is the creating of the model, okay? And the second is using the model.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you separate those things, you'll be better able to answer the question.
Okay. So, yeah, not very often I say so. Okay, so now I have to discuss that, okay, how the modeling are employed, okay? Okay, so first, before deploying it in the actual environment, you first need to create some stage run or staging run of the application. So what that staging run means is that, okay, you first have to model the application. Let's say you have a model of the application. Model of the application A. So how you create this model? Okay, you place the VM in a machine, in an identical machine, and change the allocations of the virtual machine and observe what the application performance metric, how the application performance metric is changing, and record it. Based on the collected data, you create the model. Okay, so now you're done. The creation of the model is done. So each application will have its own individual model.
But you model them separately, right?
Yeah, you have to model them separately.
Okay.
In the creation phase, you have to model them.
So that's assuming they have all the resources they want.
Actually, you vary the resources while you are creating.
Okay,
I vary the resources.
Also vary the competing
competition. So in
you simulate some
competition. After the creation is done, you place it in the actual deployment. That's the usage of this model. You place it in the actual deployment scenario. Now you have the model already ready. Now based on your demand, you may have to change the resource to some application. So some decrease, let's say, memory to application A, and increase the memory to application B. Now how the model will tell you, okay, decreasing this amount of memory, how the application performance metric is going to change.
Okay, now that you say that, there is also another question that I have. I guess, and this is somewhat related to what George said at the beginning, you need to, when you have the results of creating your model, I'm guessing you are having the results for a steady state of the application, meaning that you know that from this point in time, the application behavior will not change.
Yeah, so again, we need to distinguish between the online model updating scenario with a static model.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what Sajeev is talking about here is a static model, assuming that the application's behavior does not change.
Oh, okay.
If it's a changing, then you can do the same thing for at each epoch. Say, okay, now the application behavior is completely different, I'm going to retrain my model. So you could do that at each epoch, or you could do it in an online fashion, that you keep refining it all the time.
Yeah, the problem with the online fashion is that you don't have the ability to change the parameters, or you don't have the same freedom of changing the parameters as in this static case, right?
Right.
And so you can work just with the data you have.
Well, you could change it. If you want to change it for a short period of time, you know, if let's say you start a new epoch, if you have some flexibility in how much CPU you want to allocate for a short period of time, right? So you could force some changes into the allocation so that you can train your model and then use it for a longer period of time. But that is not this project yet.
Okay.
I mean, that's the direction that Sajeev is going towards next.
Okay. So I'm guessing that right now assumption is that the application won't change in time.
Right. So for instance, in the training mechanism, the scenario that you described will also come up, which is that as you reduce the amount of memory, you will see that the I/O requirement goes up, and that gets reflected in the competing I/O and the total available bandwidth. So you see, as you change the competing I/O, a small amount of memory, the performance degrades because the paging I/Os are being affected.
Right.
And so the model captures that paging behavior as well. In fact, one of the benchmarks, the memory benchmark, does exactly that. It allocates a fixed size array and touches different portions of the array randomly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to reduce the amount of memory below the size of the array, you start paging.
Okay.
So that's one of those applications on the table.
Just a quick comment in terms of the terminology. Maybe it's something you have read before, but for me, a model is something like abstraction or application independent thing, like a blueprint almost. So once you say we create the model for this application, I think what you mean is actually that you're instantiating a model with a specific parameters of an application. This model can be I would presume from the table a regression model or TDM. Is that a neural network?
Yeah, I use
okay.
TDM.
So those are models, right? So which are which depend on parameters, the weight and so forth, which you train and you adjust them, build those parameters according to the parameters of the application. But maybe you can refine this terminology and say instead of saying creating a model for an application, you are instantiating
correct
your model.
That's exactly right. It's instantiation of a model.
So next we invested some time in coming up with some model or using some existing techniques to see that if this model is actually accurate in predicting application performance. So I use a percentage metric for application performance. So it's I don't have the metric. So it's the actual. So that's the performance, that's the metric I used for error calculation. So now that, as I said, that you first have to train the model, and how do I calculate the accuracy is that I separated out some measurements between training versus testing. So some data points are used for training the model, and some exclusive data points are used for prediction accuracy, to calculate prediction accuracy. That's how it works for all the models. And I have used the same data for every model. So I don't,
the one comment I want to make here is that before coming up with those parameters, right, you actually tried several other possible parameters. Now, fewer parameters,
yeah,
different parameters, and then we had poor accuracy with all of those other parameters.
Yeah, the main parameter choice that we found is very less accurate is one with the disk and disk. Because the first we tried with only ionized. Then we realized that if the use of ionized is not enough.
Right.
We have to employ another parameter. That's the competition parameter. While with CPU memory, I mean, we didn't choose some experiments, we choose the strict partitioning.
So did you use another set of did you expand with another one apart from this one? Apart from memory, CPU, and this? I guess that's all, right?
Well,
that's
yeah,
not much.
We could go into caching.
Yeah, you could go into the fine level.
Okay.
But caches are not partitionable, that's the problem.
Well, you can partition with
right.
The V extension.
With what extension?
With VT extension.
VT extension.
You can say don't delete this entry.
What architecture?
VT extension. That's just V for virtualization.
Really?
Yeah.
VT?
VT, yeah. That's in Intel and AMD.
I think
AMD.
You don't flush that.
You will not flush. I mean, you can mark some of the TLB entries and tell it, don't flush this guy, don't flush this guy.
No, with TLB you can follow them, but for caches like DL2, can you do that?
Yeah, you can do it with the VT.
Oh. Actually, I'm talking about that later. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Maybe we should
postpone
the discussion until that day.
Yeah.
But the point is that these models can only give you, or instantiation of the models can only give you accuracy good if your chosen parameters are good.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't use the right parameters, you might use some complex ANN technique, a neural network technique, and it will give you very lousy prediction error. So the real key is to choose the right parameters to instantiate the model with.
Now, there's another as well set of parameters that pertain to the model itself. For neural network, for example, you have the number of layers, the intermediate layers.
Those are internal parameters. I'm talking about the external parameters.
Correct, but
I can talk about that.
In selecting your external parameters, you said, I ruled out some of them because the prediction was poor.
Mm.
So a reviewer will tell you, I mean, why your parameters were correct, but you are not choosing the right number.
I have tested all kinds of combinations. To answer your question, I have tested all kinds of combinations.
So the methodology is basically experimentation in your case. You experimented with several hidden layers, different nodes per hidden layer, and so forth.
Yes, exactly.
With a reasonable amount of combinations.
Yes, exactly.
So for some of the benchmarks, the error, the average error is pretty high, right? Let's say for the OLTP, it's at least 20-something percent.
Yeah, of course, but thing is that, okay, so...
So do you have any idea why that?
Yeah, of course, because thing is that, okay, all this regression model, it's reporting high error in case of average, right, in OLTP. The thing is that in regression model, it closely follows a conventional mathematical equation.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Let's say regression linear. So it would follow a linear equation and try to fit those all the data points
into
a linear curve. Or in case of quadratic, it will try to fit those all the data points into a quadratic curve. But what we observe from the OLTP is the observation.
Mm-hmm.
What we observe from the actual data is that the change of application performance metric or change of OLTP throughput is can vary or changes in a it could be super linear depending
on
the
it doesn't follow either of those behaviors.
Exactly.
That but also is piecewise model, right?
Piecewise
for some part of the parameter space it's quadratic maybe, but it's not quadratic for the rest of the parameter space, and then trying to fit everything within a quadratic model doesn't work.
For example, in case of OLTP measure, I can remember an example is that as I have partitioned into several memories, let's say, from low to, at some point, in the beginning, from initial low memory to some high memory, you have very high influence on the memory. So your application performance metric changes a lot as you change the memory. But after a certain point, you observe a very low gain of memory.
Low gain of
performance as you change the memory. So those are the kind of behavior is very hard to follow with a mathematical equation, because after you have piecewise changes. So in some portion it is highly memory dependent, and after some point it's not that all that memory dependent.
So I mean I don't see why then neural networks will give you something better, because neural networks you will need a whole bunch.
Well, in neural network it is giving some better result, 8.48%.
But
why does it give better than that?
Yeah, I mean, how complex is your neural network?
Well, that's the idea of employing some statistical techniques, or that is evolving, yeah. That is self-adaptive and evolving.
Well, the power of neural networks basically is that it can model a nonlinear relation, which basically the regressors,
mm-hmm.
what are going to do is basically approximate to some curve, which could be
some
a
curve, exactly.
Right, so now the tricky part, I think, in this on this stage was to be able to somewhat demonstrate that you follow a methodology for choosing the regressors, number of regressors, and the configuration for your neural network that achieves the best possible prediction power.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which I think you could use some other techniques as well to validate if a parameter, application parameter, is worth putting into the model. There's the entropy metric, for example, that you can measure from your data, from your observation, I mean, from the training set. So you might try as well
some other evolution.
Put in, like, I mean, try
some other complex
technology for saying this is what I follow to select the parameters, and this is how I also select the internal configuration of each one of these methods.
Maybe
so
you want to talk about
I did that actually, because things that in ANN, that in these three regions,
mm-hmm.
it's actually the several combinations of the ANN itself. Because in ANN, what was the very important internal parameter apart from hidden layers and hidden neurons is the activation function itself.
Mm-hmm.
So what the activation function does you is that at each layer. I mean, for example, let's go to the next picture. Let's say, what the activation function will allow you, okay, from this input to here, how you map here to this node. So that's the job of the activation function. And the choice of this activation function is really important, because as you can see that this three, as you change the activation function, you have a very
linear Gaussian and
Elliot or different activation function?
Different activation function. This has different metrics.
For the same neural network architecture.
For the same neural network, and keeping all the other things kind of the same, like in the neural layers. So actually, I tried with several combinations to come up with this. The intuition of Elliot is that that I invented is that this Elliot is a form of sigmoidal function which is really good in modeling non-linear behavior, and it is efficient in terms of time in comparison to sigmoidal function. And it actually shows very good accuracy across all the benchmarks. As you can see from the average and median errors are pretty low across all different types of benchmarks. So I have tested with CPU intensive, memory intensive, postmark, and OLTP. Any questions? So this is a neural network picture. I think I can skip it. So that is the important internal parameters that we are referring to, right? So my slide is not very well organized, so I could have done a better job. So first is the activation function that I talked about. One is the hidden layer and hidden neurons. Well, the thing is that in hidden layer and hidden neurons, there is no actually a definitive way or a formal way to choose a number of neurons, the number of layers. It's mostly trial and error. I mean, you have to try with different combinations before selecting one. So, but what if the neural network theory tells you is that choosing too few number of layers or too few number of neurons could actually lead to underfitting. And the vice versa as well. Choosing too many points may lead to overfitting. So we need to somehow try with several combinations and try to find out what best works in your case. But there is no formal case. At least I don't know.
I think the ANN experts will say that there is a formal way to choose.
There are some papers. There are some papers I looked at.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sure. I mean, that's their whole job, right? ANN. I mean, that's what they're doing.
No, there are papers on that. How to choose hidden layers and hidden neurons.
I mean, it would, of course, change based on what you're trying to do, but they would have some strategies how to choose neurons rather than just pick at random
and
try it.
Right?
I mean, you could do binary search for it.
Yeah. One strategy the paper I was looking into is that they say that the number of hidden layers should be in between number of inputs and number of outputs.
Mm-hmm.
That was their strategy. And they have several strategies for choosing hidden
layers. You have an upper bound?
Yeah. Some upper bound and lower bound. Okay, so this is the more experimental approach. I think I can skip this, though.
Yeah, I think you can skip that. Maybe you want to go to future work or something.
Yeah. The recap is that identification of right set of parameters is an Elliott model is accurate in modeling, which gives you in the range of the median error in the range from 1 to 7%, let's say. And training is possible with really few number of data, that is this graph tells you, because I mean, even I think I can skip it. And training time is really low, so you can really employ it in online scenario where you constantly have to change your model. Sorry. Okay, let's say for OLTP benchmark, I model the application. It's a complex benchmark. I have little discussion on that. I model the application with 180 data points.
That's your training set.
That's the main training set.
Then your entire training set, what's the set?
What, 360? Yeah. I mean, in the paper, if you look at my paper, it's not in published yet, but if you look at my draft, it tells you how you choose your training data. So there is a formal mechanism I follow to choose my training data point, or an algorithm I follow to choose my training data point.
How many attributes
each data set?
How many parameters?
It's just
I haven't employed the network yet, so I have tried with CPU memory and this. So the parameters are four parameters. One is the CPU gap, that is the share of CPU. One is the memory, and it's the IONI. And one is the computing IO, that is why we talk this CDIO, yes. Computing this cycle per second. So these are actually served as an input. And corresponding to that, you have one application performance metric. That is output. So you have four input and one output. So that's your one data point, or one data point.
So this
CPU
gap,
yeah, I mean, initially we lost hope because we thought that it's just not doable.
Yeah,
it's our errors. I don't know if you remember the error numbers that we had.
Yeah, because we have encountered several problems. First, we are not choosing the right activation function. And we are not choosing the right parameters. So in the beginning, we are not choosing the right parameters.
Mm.
And we say that, okay, we just, our main focus was to minimize the number of influencing parameters. So we just figured first, pick out three, and it says, no, it's not working out. Then we figured out, okay, there is a way we can measure the competition, and that the combination of priority versus combination actually helps in controlling this. So after that, we have some improvements. And later we find out that even we are wrong in activation function because we are dealing with ANN linear. So that was not giving very accurate result. But then we find out, okay, how to...
And also the choice of the training point.
Choice of the training
point. If you don't choose the right training point, then that's the problem too.
So did you try other machine learning applications?
No, not yet.
So how... Why
do you decide to try these? Not other. By accident? Because
for some reason.
Yeah, I think the reason is simple. I don't know. This is the reason you're looking for. There was a package of implementation of ANN that was available, and I think, Sajeev, you tried all the activation functions.
Yeah.
Right, and we just show three because you cannot fit everything in the table.
No, she's talking about other machine learning techniques,
like
fuzzy logic, active learning.
And maybe non-supervised methods.
Unsupervised learning.
Yeah, non-supervised methods as well. And of course, using this, I guess, in the fit forward supervised neural network.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't try any of this. The reason is you start somewhere, and if you're satisfied, you stop. but that's not the right answer. The answer is, well, let's hope that someone else does the evaluation with the other. The key contribution of this work is, I think, the parameter rather than the training model, because we're really not creating those training models.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Coming up with the right parameters was critical to modeling these applications. Then eventually we found the right modeling technique, and maybe there are even better techniques out there that we've not explored yet. But the number of techniques are infinite,
mm-hmm.
arguably. So, I think the real contribution is in the parameters. That's how.
Even in the modeling, could
or maybe the identification of the training data form. There is a
training methodology is important.
Yeah.
Training methodology is really important.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how you partition training data form. That's very important.
Not in here,
but I can later. And there is a formal approach to do that. It's complex.
So I think it would be the key function.
Training methodology, parameters.
One thing is that we use the same training methodology to all the models.
So our training methodology is independent of any type of modeling. So, okay, so now I can talk about the current work or the work with the gamut. That's the main purpose. I mean, you create a model and how you're going to use it in an actual deployment scenario, right? And what is the overall goal of, I mean, what data methods or data synthesis could potentially do with the help of this model? So one is the one thing we have to do is that online modeling before employing in the deployment center, you have to need to develop a model which is self-adaptive because the application behavior can change drastically. So you need to develop a model. The challenge here is to differentiate between the transitory change and the stable change. One of the challenges of creating this online model. Right? Because the model should be able to differentiate between those changes and take into account only the changes which are stable in nature. So that's one challenge I'm facing right now. And overall, I want to use this model for developing a process that will dynamically allocate resources to a set of virtual machines, sharing the resources in our data center, which will actually maximize service level agreement based for profit for the administrator. So by that, what I mean is that and that's my objective. Is that yes, a DMA, and you have several applications. You have the resources. Each application reports its application performance. And what service level agreement tells you is that. Okay, service level agreement tells you that, okay, with this performance metric, let's say X, you will have some amount in dollars, let's say Y. And if this application performance is different, then the client will give you, let's say, different amount of dollars. So what we want to do is that, and that's the same for all the applications, they will give some our goal is to, at any instant, is to maximize this, the summation of this. So that the data center, you devise an algorithm which will guarantee that the data center is always making a maximum profit with the availability of the resources and the application instance.
And that maximization is automatic by automatically changing the allocation.
Yeah. That's my overall goal of doing that. First I created a model, a static model, then I have to make it dynamic, and with this dynamic modeling, I need to figure out an algorithm which will maximize this cost. Or change the resources which will guarantee that my profit will be maximized. Any questions?
Good, so I guess we should go on to someone else then.
Yeah.
Next discussion. Wants to do the next discussion? Ricardo?
Yeah. We should go a little faster, right?
seems like we have more people than we have time, right? So we might have to spill over into next week and continue next week. So let's take it easy and relax and.
You're alright?
And it's okay to break it up into two sessions.
Just plug it there.
Too much content.
That's good, right? I mean, too little content is a problem. Too much content is a problem, but we can deal with it.
Apparently, we're going to use the
Well, yeah, I have to get
down
to the
Okay. I guess I was expecting either George or Leonardo to talk about it. I don't know if they are planning to do that. George, are you planning to talk about SoftPM?
If we do another session, I can talk about the other project too.
Okay. It's probably not going to happen today. So we'll do next Monday. Okay, yeah, sure. Thanks for coming. I mean, my goal is to for you to know about some of the projects that we are doing and maybe strike up some collaboration.
Right.
There are some things that we can do together. And that's really why I invited you.
Yeah, it's good to know.
Okay. So, yeah. Yeah, next week I'll send out a time.
Okay.
Yeah. It's probably going to be around the same time next Monday.
Okay.
Are you going to be around next Monday?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
When are you leaving?
Next Friday.
Oh, okay.
Eight zero,
yeah.
It wasn't the soccer
game.
Oh.
Who's playing who?
It's a World Cup. But
World Cup?
Yeah, but it's a sub on under 20, U20. So Venezuela beat Haiti 8-0.
Haiti.
Haiti, no.
Tahiti.
Okay. Tahiti. 8-0. Yeah, so we classify to the next round because we beat Nigeria 1-0, and now
under 20. That's a new one.
No, they have a whole bunch. They have under 17, under 15, under.
Yeah. Yes. So I'll do it quick. So the idea is that you have reuse of data and securable content. Every level in the memory stack. So you have a locality at all the caches, so the memory is serving as a cache for this, and so on. So for example, if you have a bunch of data and an executable on this, you load it on RAM, and maybe you're looking at a portion of the executable, so you load it on the first caches, and grab it fast. Thing is that,
You're saying that you have repeated constants, right? The cache are not...
You have stuff that accesses more than one.
Yeah, but I mean, are the cache unique? The data in the cache?
No, it's just an example, just an introduction.
Okay.
It can be pretty much anything. The idea is that, I mean, what I want to show is that you have some local content for an application at a specific moment. For example, you might be doing a matrix multiplication like the last time. So the algorithm might have load, the program might have load a portion of the matrix. So next part is, I mean, the next thing is to know how big is that portion the algorithm loads. And if that's important because, let's say, it loads a portion of 1 meg into the L2 cache, if you knew that that portion is 1 meg, it means that you can allocate four of those programs and they could run smoothly. If you have one more of those programs, they will start trashing out lines and then too many misses, and you'll see the effect on the performance of at least one of those programs. So you want to know how big that local portion of data is. And the first thing is how to define that segment. The basic idea is, the basic concept for that is the idea of a working set. But there are many definitions for working sets, and there's no really like a standard or like a final definition. For example, the classical working set definition is given a trace that accesses all those elements. It's just the number of different elements being accessed. And say these are memory lines, so in that case it would be 11. Another way of seeing working sets is just counting the number of elements that are being reused. In this case, only one. But for example, for the case of the L2 cache for the matrix multiplication, you see that it's not really that easy.
I mean, if we counted just as the elements that are being reused, I'm sure that, and we allocate that number of megabytes to the application on L2 cache, I'm sure will be submitted. Another possible definition for working set is this one, effective reuser, which is not fixed. It actually, we make it dependable on the number of misses we're willing to accept. For example, in this case, if we are willing to accept one miss, we can reuse, to miss A, we can have an effective reuse set of one. If we are not willing to accept any misses, we have it in a term. So you see that it can be dependent on the number of misses, you have to have it fixed.
I see. So because A is after 7, after at a distance of 7.
Yeah, exactly.
Earlier you said something that if I use the definition of reuse set, then sure that there will be some misses for the
I realize that's not wise. So I will need an actual example to think of an example.
Right.
Yes.
So you could, for instance, instead of saying I'm sure, you could say there could be.
There could be. Oh yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm being picky.
Election of words. Yeah.
It's my job to give you such advice.
Yeah. So turns out that you have on most on many applications that you studied. This case is a benchmark called NAP that does. You can say that's pretty much all type of kind of things you can imagine, which that's also unsafe to say. But just for this informal presentation, I assume it does it all. There are type of applications for it, and each query is one type of application. And we saw pretty much all the runnings that we have a local set. I mean, small working set, big working set. This case, each figure plots number of misses versus cache sizes.
So the cache is what, L1?
Sorry, in this case it includes from L1 to 10 megs. I mean, how can I say? I'm not assuming any cache. I'm just plotting this assuming
controlling
the size of the cache.
Controlling the size of the cache, yeah. I'm controlling the size of the cache.
And what is the
weight?
So X is a cache from a typical L1 to a big L2.
So it doesn't matter what level it is, it's just a cache.
It's just a cache. It's just below the process.
With assuming L or U.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And what is the Y?
No. So and Y is number of misses.
Okay.
So you see that, for example, this, in this case, this little step that fits in L1. Or this one is close to 4 megabytes that fits in L2. In this case, it could be 4 megabytes of L2. Things that you have many of those steps.
So there are some of them, you see different types of steps, right? So there's one that's like linear. That's 2-2.
Very
right?
Sharp, yeah.
Yeah.
And there are other cases where you have.
So before you said that didn't happen.
Well, that usually doesn't happen. That's an exception.
No, but it happens in that one and it happens in the other one, the one that's just
okay,
before that
two.
One.
Yeah, usually, but that's what we saw.
So, instead of saying usually, you could also say for certain types of applications which demand the reuse behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's not important for me. Yeah, okay, yeah.
So each graph, where is each graph?
Each figure is a different application.
Different application.
Yeah.
From the same benchmark.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Something more to see on applications is that those working sets have been changed during the execution of the application. For example, for the matrix multiplication case, the blocks have changed. And those transitions can be seen as spikes in misses when you plot it versus instructions or time. You are running with a local set and you are hitting into the cache. Then you change to a different working set, and to change the working set you have to miss. So if you plot it that way, for example, that's a nice way of seeing transition.
Mm-hmm.
Plotting misses versus infraction. So we have also to consider. Another thing to consider is that given it's more likely to have a small working set during small range of instructions. If you have a large execution, it's very unlikely that it's just using a small portion of data, right?
Couldn't it be good because you're always using, the proportion of data that you're using is just always the same, just that the execution is a long data?
Well, it could be. The thing is that that's something else to model.
Okay.
Right? So the thing with that is that there are many things to be modeled in an application. Size of these working sets, how transitions are happening, how small from the number of instructions point of view is this transition, this phase. I mean, a phase is a constant execution.
So you want to model execution time, right?
Excuse me?
You want to model execution time?
Well, that would be nice, or response time,
in case
it's interactive application.
Okay.
That's the final goal, I would
say. Which response time have you seen? Cache.
No, application.
Yeah, that's a goal, for example. Another goal would be to determine when is an application being isolated. You know, how much do you have to give this application in terms of caches, or memory, or flash, as serving for a cache for this. Right? So to be able, for example, for a scheduler could say, I could put these two together, I cannot put these two together because they will start interacting, affecting each other caches. So a model we have for this is called a phase transition tree, the ERFS tree. The idea is that at each level you have at each node you have a phase, which includes the number of instructions, the duration of the phase. And if, you have the case that a phase can include smaller phases, right? You could see the largest phase in the execution of a program as all the data that's been touched by the program.
So it's like different execution code.
For example, given, let's analyze executable code. Just execute. The largest phase includes all the code being loaded from this to memory. At a specific time, let's say it's looping on a little while loop.
But that would be just a node, right?
Yeah, that's just a node. I mean, the biggest is a load. It's a node that's at the root of the tree, and let's say a small loop is just a leaf node.
Okay.
That's the idea. The next part is how to create this. So given an application and seeing the application as a black box, how to come up with this tree?
So when you say application, you mean the executable itself, or what?
Yeah, the executable.
Okay.
Yeah, to be precise, it's really the executable because it changes from architecture to architecture. You can use, or compilation from compilation, can use the cache differences based on how it was defined.
Mm-hmm.
Is really well analyzed and really defined and secure. The most important thing to characterize an application and having this tree is being able to partition in the cache. That's it. If you want to, let's say, have this plot, how many misses we would have if we had this amount of cache? That means that we have to somehow simulate or partition or limit the amount of cache available for an application, right? That at all levels, if they are L1, L2, if we want to find phases that are bigger than L2, you have to do it in memory. Bigger than memory, you have to do it on disk, or on flash if it's serving as a cache for disk. So the trick here is how to partition cache. That's the thing. So we started different techniques and proposed some techniques for L2. For L1, it was just too hard. For L3, it's pretty much the same. All the techniques we studied are applicable to that we use for L2 can be applicable for L3. For memory and for flash, as we didn't study them, and we think as we have direct control of what happens when there is a miss, so we can know when there is an access to memory. You could mark those pages as invalid. You could know what the page is being touched. Then you have full control, and we are assuming those cases are trivial. So pretty much all the studies we did was on how to partition L2 cache to be able to have those nice curves where we say if we give an application a bit more of cache, it would be fine. If we give it a little less, start missing, so the execution time or the response time can even double those cases. We started three techniques. The last one is our contribution, and the first two are based on previous work, not exactly proposed for this case, but somehow we are using them. The first technique is based on page coloring, as typical page coloring for PLDs, for example. The idea is that you know that on pretty much all L2 caches, there is associativity. That means that when a line is being saved in the cache, it can only be saved in a set. It cannot be saved in any part of the cache. So if we somehow limit the available lines, using that, we limit the available lines for an application that can use the cache to only half, we are effectively partitioning the cache in two. Right? So we do this by allocating pages. For example, if we want to split the cache in two, we allocate physically allocate pages for an application aligned to the double of a page. For example, if we do that, we are only using half of the possible sets for all the possible lines. So in that way, we are just using half of the line. So we're using half of the set. So we're using half of the cache. If you wanted to partition the cache in four, you physically allocate pages aligned to four times a page. Yeah, that's pretty much all we did to partition the cache. The next technique we use for partitioning the cache is based on the use of a probe.
What are the drawbacks of associativity-based partitioning?
I have a table at the end where I compare all the... But basically the problem is that you need to have another implementation of an allocation. Also, another problem is that on some virtualized environments, the address space allocated for a virtual machine is not physically contiguous. For example, we saw that there are hard restrictions that only the first gigabyte of memory is physically contiguous and the other don't. So that's a problem because the virtual machine cannot see the real stuff. So if the real hardware, if the hypervisor only provides a view of the address space as just random pages all over the place, we cannot do this kind of implementation at the virtual machine level. And another problem is that you need to recompile the application and so it uses this older version of malloc. Another technique we tried for partitioning the cache is let's say you have a cache of 4 megabytes, and you're trying to infer that the working set of this application is 2 megabytes. You could try by resizing the cache from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, something like that. And this technique uses a probe application, another application that's grabbing some cache space. So the moment there is a contention, by increasing the state from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, we will see a contention of caches at 2 megabytes. Because at 2 megabytes plus the two other 2 megabytes, the cache won't fit anymore. The working set won't fit anymore. And the thing is that we tried several approaches for how the lines have been touched by this probe. We tried reads, writes, random reads, random writes, sequential writes. None of them really worked. And then, we tried another approach that uses an instruction that's available in some processors that only touch lines. It doesn't really fetch lines from the cache to the processor, it just touches them. So you can have a application, you can have this probe touching lines faster than any other application in the system, and that's exactly what we want. The moment we touch lines a little slower than any other application in the system, that means that LRU will evict our line. We want touching as fast as possible. And the way we got this was by using just this touch line instruction. Another problem we saw is that really the real size of the cache, it's really, in case of this architecture, which was 4 megabytes, it's not really 4 megabytes because of a sensitivity problem. The thing is that because there is a sensitivity, there can be some conflicts in the way lines are being allocated to sets. There might be the case that you have the cache, you have many sets, you might have the case where some sets are not being used at all because associativity is just too poor, just too low. So there might be sets that are highly used and some sets that are not used. In order to fully use all the sets, one way is to allocate the memory for this application as completely sequential in physical memory. So if you allocate a sequential in physical memory, you will be using all the sets
uniformly.
Yeah. And experimentally, that's what we saw.
So how big is LAN?
This architecture, I didn't say. All these experiments are using the Power 6, the IBM Power 6 processor, which is PowerPC. And in that case, a line is 128 bytes. DL2 cache is 4 megabytes. DL1 cache is 64K. This case, for example, we are, this is the actual size, we're plotting, you could see CPI as the number of misses. So CPI goes high, it means there's something bad. The cache is not being, there's not enough cache. So when you use typical allocation, we saw that at 2.5 megabytes, the cache was not enough. And then we tried allocating the memory for that application as completely sequential in physical memory, and we saw that you really see the limit at 4 megabytes, which is the expected, right? So that's something else to consider. And we consider this by implementing the probe using memory in this way. So by using the probe implementing it this way, we see that we have more accuracy. The way we are determining that this application is using 2 megabytes of cache is closer to 2 megabytes. The CMAX elevation, which uses contiguous memory, the sequential physical memory. It's better to use sequential memory. That's the conclusion. Another approach we use for partitioning the cache is based on simulation, simulating different types of caches. The problem is that for that you need to have actual accesses, real traces for memory. Once you have real accesses for memory, you have a trace, you can use, let's say, an NRU stack, and you just vary the size of the stack, and you'll have your misses versus cache size. The thing is that, so you need to have, for having these traces at the L2 level, you need to have all the L2 access. You need to have traces of L2 access. And we did that with...
So you want all memory access or all L2 access?
L2 access. If you want to find faces hasta que an analysis larger than L2, you need to do it at the memory level. If you want it more than the memory level, you do it at a flash level. So we did this using, and actually it's a mix of a lot of stuff, but the basic thing is that on this Power 6 architecture, there is this magic register called YesDAC, which can contain the operands of, things that at every instruction, this register will contain the operands of the instruction, at each instruction. So if, let's say, you interrupt the machine at the at every L1 miss, that means L2 miss, L2 hit. If you interrupt the machine to, if you configure the machine to interrupt at every L1 miss, then you just check the ESDAR register and you'll see the operands for the instruction. So the instruction usually that misses is a log or a store. So you get the operand, and the operand will be the address. Right? So you just dump the address and you'll have a trace of L2 access. So that's what we're doing. So now we have three techniques. Associativity, the probe one, and this trace one. And another technique is to use a full system simulator. A full system simulator is not like VMware ESX or Workspace. It's really a simulator that actually implements virtually registers and all the details of an architecture. The problem with those is that they are very, very slow, more than 100 times slower. But the accuracy can be really good. And then the next approach, I mean, from bottom to top, is the trace one. There is some overhead. We measure the overhead as 1.3 times more slower, because there are interrupts for every. There is one interrupt for every point, for every for every event. That's the problem.
It should be two, right? I said 1.2.
Why is two?
Because
L2 level? The hit ratio for L1 is very, very high. I mean, very few instructions go to L2. For L1, it just hangs. For L1, every... another problem is that it's highly intrusive because you require... you need to modify the kernel, you need high privileges, and the other approach was the probe one, having this application that's grabbing portions of the cache. The overhead is, until the moment there is contention, there is no overhead, really. It's non-intrusive because it's just another application running in the system, but the quality is pretty low. The associativity based one is the one with the best quality because that way we are really, really partitioning the cache. The problem is that it requires recompilation of applications and it needs a new implementation of MAP, or an alternative implementation of MAP.
So the quality being medium is just because you don't know if the cache is using LRU or not. Is that why you put medium there?
Actually, I haven't mentioned it because I don't remember. Yeah. Now it's not making sense. But at that time, I'm sure this was based on a presentation I did at IBM. At that time, I'm sure it made sense. But now I don't remember.
I think the reason is because for the trace and simulation, you don't know whether it's a perfect LRU or not, and you're implementing a
oh yeah, event. Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because there are many things that the trace based approach is not doing, like prefetching. Lines and some advanced replacement techniques extra to LRU are being implemented in the cache. For example, there are some data that has some priority over others. For example, in some types of caches like the Power 6 one, executable content has somehow more priority to other type of lines.
Okay.
This figure shows how the RSS was calculated for the four techniques for four applications. And there's no point of showing this. Yeah. Now we try to apply all those techniques to the L1 cache. There is associativity at the L1 level, so that technique can be applied. The probe one, that was very hard to have control at that very tiny amount of memory. It was very hard, and actually, I don't think any of our results are making any sense for that.
Simulation again is what?
The simulation is full simulation. A full simulation, like Mambo or Valgrind or something like that.
Well, Valgrind is a single...
Yeah, actually, Valgrind simulates caches and all, but that's only for one application.
Right.
Which could be a VM. Yeah. Mm.
Which could be a VM?
I mean, theoretically, you could run, let's say, a VMware workstation is really a process, right?
Mm.
User-level
virtualization.
Yeah. The trace approach was impossible because it requires one interruption per load or store, which that's not. No, we just tried just in case it hangs. It had to hang. This is mainly a chat work. The idea was to how to extend all this idea to be able to say things like given an application, let's say this application UA and application DC, how much cache they really need. I mean, you would assume that it's just adding one and the other, right? But that's not actually the case. As we see in this case, these columns, you can see we're putting on the same machine this one and this one.
Mm-hmm.
This one is using 3 megs.
It's UAMG application work.
Some work. I don't remember. Doesn't matter.
Okay.
The thing though is that we're putting these two and see what happened, and then we're putting this one and this one.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing what happened. The important thing is that MG has very few misses, and DC has a lot of misses, right? Has like 4-5 times more misses.
Well, why could it be less misses when you consolidate UA and MG?
You have more misses than MG, but less misses than UA alone.
I think it's misses per...
Yeah, it's misses per something. I don't remember. Meters per 10,000, meters per 1,000 instructions or something.
Oh, okay. So it's a combination.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was some.
Yeah. Things that if you add UA and MG, you need 3.85 megs, which is a bit larger. But if you add UA and DC, in this case DC was missing a lot, you need much more than 3.5.
Why?
That's what we're trying to model. The thing is that DC is, we're seeing as the, we have the cache. DC is using, UA is using this, and DC is using this. Things this ERSS idea, this working set idea, doesn't mean that at this moment this is only using this portion of data. This portion of data was this portion of data in RAM. It doesn't mean that it was only using this. It means that the moment you give this application a little bit less than this in cache, you start missing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Things that you see this, and this, right? This is this amount. This is this. but there are still other elements, other lines being accessed that might not be reused,
mm-hmm.
or are not being reused as much as this. And let's say at this moment, at this phase, UA is using a lot of extra lines which are not being used. It's just that it's using lines that are affecting the execution of this feed. It's like this guy is flooding this feed cache.
So basically, at the end, it's not like, I mean, the step is drastic after some point, but after that, it keeps lowering a little bit.
No, it's not that it keeps lowering. It's just that it means that what I'm trying to say is that there are still other stuff being accessed. I mean, UA is reusing this a lot, but at the same time it's running with DC, can be loading more stuff to the cache.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that that's not only one step, it's just that one really big step and really small steps.
No, because I'm saying that this is not being reused. UA is not reusing this.
Okay.
So you don't have any...
So those, you can think of those elements that enter the cache and they leave, they're not staying there anymore.
It's just grabbing these,
yeah.
to mess with this cache. Yeah, that's a nicer way of saying it. Yeah. So how much it messes with this cache? And we're measuring that as the total, as the number of misses it's doing. Because if it's a miss, it means it wasn't in the cache and it's actually being... just loaded and not used. Well, it could be used, but okay. But
used
the first time it's missing, it's just messing with this stuff.
You need to bring those additional lines in, and as a consequence, you have to pull something out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if not, take that something out, it's DC. Yeah. So that's the next thing we're trying to model. And I haven't shown anything because we have very few results. Just from
so consolidation is hard here.
Yeah. But that's kind of for me. Yeah,
I mean, just knowing that you need 4.18 megabytes, and that 4.18 is substantially different than 3.5. I think that's a
That's the thing. Yeah.
That's an advantage.
Yeah.
Right?
Because typically, traditionally people would say that you need 3 plus 0.5. And we see that that's not the case. And actually depends on the number of misses. I guess we think it depends on the number of misses on how this guy is flooding this other guy. Yeah. And the next important thing to consider is that, I mean, in this case we're starting the S2 cache because that's the hardest one, but this should be applied to all levels of the memory stack.
So you still want to run them at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you could run them one after the other and use less cache. And have less amount of misses.
Yeah, but it's better to use all
the cache.
No, I
mean, you're just asking.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you consolidate, I mean, if you're, I mean, it's just like serializing versus parallelizing.
Yeah.
I guess running several applications at the same time makes sense that there are...
If you save time.
No, but I'm talking about when you have multiple cores, let's say, where you share cache, like L3 cache or RAM, it makes sense to do this kind of thing.
I think one of the applications for this work is virtualized environments. So you run multiple virtual machines, so each of those applications could be a virtual machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And how do you partition? How do you find out what is the correct set of virtual machines to consolidate on a single physical host? So how many machines to put in there?
Yeah.
Cache partitioning and cache contention will affect that decision.
Yeah. And cache contention is, I mean, it's a very important point. I mean, cache contention is just paging of applications to disk, right? The moment an application starts paging, it can decrease performance, like, I guess, 10 times or more. The same is, like, from paging to L1 to L2, or L2 to L1, L2 to memory, because it's the same proportion of speed access. So to summarize this work, the main thing is that working set is a vague idea. There are many definitions, and we need a precise and applicable definition. And that's what we're proposing with the RSS idea. A program execution is divided in phases. We detect phases by this transition that we see as spikes. And we have proposed an algorithm for detecting those phases. We propose a model that includes all those ideas, phases, transitions, working set, execution, duration of working set, as this generalized phase and transition tree, that tree that I was showing you. Then I said that the basic thing for characterizing an application is how to partition caches. And I showed four ways for partitioning the L2 and L3 cache. And then the next thing was how to use this information for isolation. That's pretty much all we have.
So one question I have is, if you have a virtualized system, you're not going to have, there's still virtual threads, right?
Hyper-threads. The thing, hyper-threads are another. So a hyper-thread can give you a strict partitioning for the L2 cache.
Mm-hmm.
With hyper-thread, you partition the L2 cache in the two maximum, and half partition.
Okay.
So you could see just as one.
You're talking about Intel HyperThread?
Yes. Or on PowerSig, there's also HyperThread. It's just saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why don't you use something like that?
Because this will also only give us one level of partition, right?
Yeah. This one
not arbitrary partition.
You cannot say one.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So just
that would be nice.
House.
Yeah. And there are some futuristic caches being proposed in conference like Atlas and stuff like that that can tag cache lines for specific processes or VMs.
Mm-hmm.
But and you said you mentioned these BT instructions, right?
Yeah, but now that I remember, it's TLB entries, not
just TLB entries.
TLB entries.
Another proposed type of caches are ones that have where you can set priorities of lines. These lines are more likely to be listed than so that can be used for stuff like this. No real implementation architecture that I know.
But will you be able to have all that information you need in a virtualized setting?
At least from PowerSig and.
No, but I'm talking, like in a real deployment, in a real data center, would you be able to have all the information you need?
For example, what technique, let's say to partition the cache by associativity.
Yeah.
In that case, ESX ensures that all the memory allocated for a machine is contiguous. ESX.
Okay.
Is physically contiguous.
Okay.
Some other, like this IBM virtualization thing that I don't remember the name.
Don't
they ensure only the first gigabyte.
Okay.
I'm sure them does something.
Same thing is also the first gigabyte.
Just the first gigabyte. Yeah. So if you have, you have that first gigabyte, you can do whatever you want. So you can allocate memory there.
There was also another idea which we discussed was the sensitivity of the probing techniques for to the scheduling of the CPU.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So if you schedule a CPU in a unusual way, then the probe doesn't work.
Yeah, because the probe needs to. What the probe allocates this. It needs to be least this, nor more, nor less. If you make the probe too slow, it means that you will touch lines very once in a while.
Yeah, if you make it too big.
So in the meanwhile, there are other applications that can be using it. So it needs to be faster than anybody else. And you can make it faster by giving it more processors, for example. Or well, many of but we haven't actually tried.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, so instead of having a single probe process, you could have multiple probe processes so that you divide the CPU in such a way that
you're ensuring that it has more CPU. Yeah, we haven't.
So, but I mean, still, after you, the thing is that you will not be able, you will only be able to play with CPU quotas, right? You will not be able to play with how much cache it's going to use at the end.
No, I mean, we are really playing with how much cache it's using. I mean, we saw the experiments, right?
I mean, when you consolidate, how will you, I mean, you will just determine how much cache you will use, but you will not determine, I mean, you're not able to separate how much each application is using.
I don't get your question.
It's not, you're saying it's not strict partitioning. That
yeah,
you,
exactly.
Yeah, it's just, the idea is just that if you put two applications together with a certain amount of cache, will they be isolated or not? So it becomes a very specific question that we are trying to answer. We are not saying that to run this application you need so much amount of cache, and we guarantee to that the application will always have that amount of cache.
Okay.
It's a more loose and it's a non-strict kind of question where you ask, if I put these applications together,
is the interference between them?
Yeah. Are these applications isolated from a cache standpoint? And if they are, then maybe it's good to put them on the same machine. If they're not, maybe I should not be putting them on the same machine because performance is going to be affected substantially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I have two comments, I guess. So one comment I have is the way you get the traces. I think at some point we discussed in detail how you get that traces. And
there is a problem.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. We got to the conclusion that it didn't work for some reason.
It's not. You miss some event.
I don't remember exactly.
Yeah,
what
I don't remember that.
But actually, well, what I remember is that it was really bad.
It was
actually.
I don't know what you're talking about. Sorry.
You know, we profile the application to be able to get L2 accesses.
Yeah.
Using that technique, but we started that technique and we came up with a lot of situations where we were not able to get.
Okay, so your profiling technique is not working, correct?
Yeah.
So the traces may not be.
Yeah. So they're not complete.
Okay.
They're not complete.
Yeah. That's the problem.
I thought you were around.
No,
you were.
It's just that. I don't remember what the problem was, that at the moment there is an interruption, we lost something, some events, but I don't remember how it was.
Really, we're talking about different problems.
That's the thing we discussed.
No, no, what I'm saying is that there is an additional problem. I remember that at some point we need to talk about that again. You know, I'm also in the trace, memory trace.
Yeah. No. The problem was with tracing access to memory. It was with a different thing. The problem was we tried to trace memory access by marking pages as invalid.
No.
But
even if the page is in
the caches and it's marked as invalid, you still have an interrupt. So.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure if it's that, but it seems like it is. The other question is, there is this technique to partition the cache that you mentioned that is called associative.
Yeah.
That you need to change the malloc.
Yeah.
Implementation.
Yeah.
So
that's
this
page covering.
Mm-hmm. So the implementation, you need to change it in the kernel or in the user space?
In the kernel, because you need to have access to physical memory.
Right. So that means that you don't need to recompile the application, right?
No, there is a bit of detail that you need to do at the user level as well.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there is not really a malloc system call, right? It uses mmap.
Right, right. So then what you're saying is that the code change that need to do is not in the kernel.
In both.
Both.
Yeah.
Kernel and users.
Yeah.
So it would be in the application, in the library, and the kernel.
Well, the application can still call malloc and will change the application that, I mean, the library that's being binded to that code, right?
I'm trying to think if you really need to change the application code or not, which I think is a bad thing to do, right? But, I mean, if you have to change, because I'm thinking
this
is because you mentioned that it's a high precision and
really the problem is that we change it mmap, and if we change it mmap directly that mmap version, everybody that's using mmap will get affected. So we need a copy mmap, and these guys will use this copy of mmap. So it's just a matter of pointing to the source mmap.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
So I guess we're out of time today, but we can continue next week. We can meet at 4 o'clock perhaps. At that time, at least I don't have any other engagement. If everyone is available, we can meet next Monday at 4 p.m.
Sure.
So, Louis, you can talk about your stuff. Ariel, you can talk about him.
Quickly.
Yeah,
I
don't think I will have time. Not really.
Mine's going to be short.
Okay. Because it took everybody about an hour, right?
Really?
Yeah.
I think we should, I think we should make the presentations a little bit more concise.
Yeah.
I think it's fine. I mean, as long as what we are discussing is productive and useful to whoever is presenting their work, it's okay. And we're doing this once in 2 months, so I think it's all right to take a little bit more time. I somehow miscalculated the amount of time we will need. I thought half an hour should be more than sufficient.
Probably we're meeting after a long time, so we are falling behind a lot of
things. That's
the beginning. Maybe from next time we don't have to discuss that in detail.
Okay, so if we need more time, then maybe we should meet earlier than 4, maybe 3 o'clock only.
Let's make it 3 o'clock just in case.
Yeah.
We finish earlier.
Okay, so 3 o'clock next week, then.
Thanks, Ariel.
Bye.